The Peter Schiff Show. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. We all have our own unique challenges when it comes to work, health, family, and relationships. I've got a lot on my plate, and knowing how to recharge is crucial to my mental health. How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. At times, therapy has helped me and my loved ones in many ways, like learning positive coping skills, setting boundaries, and empowering us to become the best versions of ourselves. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major traumas. With the right guide, you can discover effective strategies to minimize distractions and truly connect with your needs, setting the stage for a more balanced life. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched up with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/gold today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/gold. Wouldn't it be great if you could see all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? With Yahoo Finance, you can consolidate your views from multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures that you have the right insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com. I've been using Yahoo Finance since Yahoo began. I was searching on Yahoo before Google existed, and in fact, my personal email address is still a Yahoo address. But Yahoo remains my go-to site. When I need information about especially U.S.-listed companies, I always go to Yahoo Finance to look that information up. Plus, I also enjoy reading their articles and watching some of their video interviews. I even enjoy participating in their video interviews because Yahoo Finance has been interviewing me almost as long as there's been a Yahoo Finance. So take it from me, Yahoo Finance should be in every investor's toolkit. Welcome to another live Peter Schiff Show podcast. And I want to remind everybody once again, give me the thumbs up whether you like this podcast or not. Say that you like it, comment on it, and subscribe to my YouTube channel if you're not currently a subscriber. You know, you guys slacked off a bit last podcast. You still did good. I think we have 11 or 12,000 likes, but it's a little bit fewer than we had in the podcast before with the same amount of views. So step it up. If you forgot to hit that like button last time, make sure and hit it this time. Well, the financial crisis that I believe we're already in, now this is, of course, the early stages of that financial crisis. It is unfolding before your eyes, if you're awake or smart enough to recognize what you see. But it's going to get a lot worse. At some point, people are going to realize that we're in a financial crisis, although they're not going to realize why. You know, they're all going to be just as blindsided by this financial crisis as they were by the much smaller financial crisis in 2008 that also took them by complete surprise. And if you remember back then, they were describing the crisis as, you know, a 100-year flood. You know, nobody could have possibly predicted this, right? I mean, this was a confluence of events. You know, this was a crazy black swan that, you know, nobody could have foreseen, which, of course, was all a bunch of BS, because a number of people, myself included, not only saw it in advance, but spent years warning about it. I mean, I wrote a book about it. So the signs were there. You just had to be cognizant of them, and you had to, you know, read them. It wasn't even like they were written in Chinese or something. It was pretty clear what was about to happen. And, you know, the same thing this time. In fact, I think it's even more clear. I mean, this is the most obvious financial crisis that nobody sees coming. I mean, this isn't even a black swan. I mean, this isn't even a white swan. This is like a pigeon. They're everywhere, right? I mean, this is a very common bird that, you know, is not coming out of left field. It's just, you know, it's right there, right? I mean, but, you know, Wall Street has a big vested interest in ignoring this, and so does a lot of people on Main Street. So does academia, the financial media, the government. Nobody wants to acknowledge this until, of course, it already happens. And then they have to figure out who the scapegoat is. But whoever they end up blaming it on, the solution is always, well, we just need more government, right? They never look back and reflect on government's role in creating the crisis. No. They're too busy pointing fingers at somebody in the private sector and holding out government as the salvation. We just need more government. If we only had more regulations, then this wouldn't have happened. No, it happened because we had too many regulations. What we need is free market regulations. Those are the ones that work. Government regulations don't. And not only don't they work, but they sabotage the free market regulations that actually do work. Now, what was going on this week in the market was a continuation of the rise in long-term bond yields. As I've been predicting on this program since before the rise began, this is relentless. And during the week, yesterday, in fact, and maybe early this morning, bond yields hit new highs. The yield on a 30-year Treasury was now not only over 5%, but over 5.1%. In fact, the high intraday this morning was 5.144%. Now, we did get some profit-taking, I guess, people who had shorted bonds, and they made a lot of money this week, short bonds. They covered, I guess, into the week, and there was a rally, not a big rally, but bonds recovered those losses, and the yield on a 30-year closed at 5.089%. This is, again, the highest weekly close, and that would have been the highest close, you know, going back to 2007 since yesterday. So yields are moving higher. The yield on a 10-year momentarily got above 5% as well intraday, just barely, before buyers stepped up and the yield backed off to 5.089. But still another backup on the week. In fact, the only maturities now on the yield curve that are below 5% are the 5-year and the 10-year. The 5-year is 4.862. But a 3-month, a 6-month, a 2-year, they're all above 5%. And the 30-year is above 5%. The yield curve is pretty flat around that 5% number, but it's not going to stay flat. It's going to steepen out. I expect long-term interest rates to continue the march upward, and we should put more distance between a 90-day, 6-month Treasury bill and a 10 to 30-year Treasury bond, especially the 30-year bond. I mean, that one is going to take the biggest hit. But I think that if this yield curve normalizes by the end of next year, I think that the short rates, which are now around 5.5, they may move up closer to 6. But at the same time, the longer end, the 10 to 30 year, that's going to move up to 7 to 8 at a minimum. Now, the question is, will the Fed allow that to happen? Will the financial markets, will the banking sector, will the economy, will the government be able to withstand that increase? I mean, so far, it seems like, okay, you know, we're surviving 5%, although I don't really think we are. Again, I think the numbers belie the problems that underline the economy. First of all, we got the leading economic indicators that came out yesterday, and they came out negative again for the 16th consecutive month. Now, I mean, that's pretty rare. I mean, you have to go back to 2007, 2008, which was the Great Recession, right? The worst recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. So you got to go back there to find a string of negative leading economic indicators that's longer than the 16 months we got now. And in fact, it was worse than expected. They were looking for minus 0.4, and we got minus 0.7, which was way worse than any expectations. That the range of expectations was from minus 0.2 to minus 0.5, and we were minus 0.7. And to add insult to injury, we revised down the previous negative month from negative 0.4 to negative 0.5. So the economy is a lot weaker than the experts are telling us. That's what the leading economic indicators are saying. I mean, if the economy is so strong, how can these leading economic indicators be so weak? But the bigger banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and a lot of the regional banks just got clobbered. But American Express was leading the decline, down 5.4%. They reported earnings, and they're just reporting just the early stages of problem. But anybody who was loaning out money during the bubble is going to have a problem getting the money back as the bubble deflates. So this is just the tip of a big iceberg for American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, you know, all these credit card companies, because there's going to be a wave of credit card defaults. I mean, we already have record credit card interest rates, over 20%. At the same time, we have record credit card balances. How can the consumer afford to pay record high rates on a record high amount of debt? He can't, especially since he's paying more for food, energy, insurance, healthcare, you name it. It's more expensive, and so these defaults are coming. But the economy is weak. Look at the solar panel. There was this solar stock that was down. SolarBridge Technologies reported bear earnings, down 27% on the day. New 52-week low. That stock is now 76% below its 52-week high. Obviously, Americans can't afford to buy solar panels. That's a big upfront cost in order to put those things on. So any kind of discretionary purchase, a big ticket, there's just no way. I mean, maybe people were financing these things before with cheap credit, but that's not available anymore, so they can't buy, right? If consumers can't borrow, they can't buy. That's why housing sales are collapsing. Autos, anything that requires debt to buy is out of reach for most Americans. Anyway, we got a quick commercial. I got a lot more to talk about, so stick around. We'll be right back.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Another indicator of the underlying weakness of the U.S. economy is the weakening fiscal position of the U.S. government. Because remember, if times are good, then more people are paying more taxes because they're earning more money, and fewer people are drawing on government benefits because they don't need them because things are great. But the fiscal position of the United States continues to deteriorate. We got the numbers actually end for the government's reporting. And first of all, the budget deficit in September came out at twice what they expected. They expected $85.5 billion of red ink during the month. And instead, we got $170.9 billion. So higher than the worst estimate, but double what they expected. And for the entire year, the official budget deficit was $1.7 trillion. That's what Congress claimed the deficit was. But of course, I don't look at what Congress claims the deficits were. I just look at the increase in the national debt, because that's a more honest number. Because the national debt actually includes everything that the government borrowed. The official budget only includes what they borrowed to pay for on-budget items. I mean, this is ridiculous, right? If something is not on the budget and the government pays for it, they don't count it. So, for example, if there's a a natural disaster, and the government has relief for that natural disaster, and let's say that's, you know, $50 billion that they have to spend for disaster aid, they don't actually count the money that they borrowed to pay for that disaster relief as part of the budget deficit, because they say, well, you know, it wasn't budgeted for. We didn't plan on it. It was unexpected. So we're going to pretend that we didn't pay that money. Can you imagine, you know, families ran their household like that? They's like, well, if there's an unexpected expense, we'll just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. I mean, you got to pay it. And in fact, they did pay it. They borrowed the money to do it. So all of the stuff that's off budget still requires debt to finance it. And so the national debt still goes up whether the government planned on spending the money or not. I mean, it doesn't matter what they intended to do. What matters is what they actually did. And so during the fiscal year where the official budget deficit was $1.7 trillion, the actual national debt rose by better than $2 trillion. And it could have been closer to $2.5 trillion because in the first week or two of October, the national debt jumped by $500 billion, like half a trillion in a couple of weeks. Now, some of that spending really probably happened, you know, in the prior fiscal year. So maybe the national debt actually increased closer to $2.5 trillion during the same time period where the government officially acknowledged or claimed that the national debt rose by $1.7 trillion, which is still a huge number. But it was actually much bigger than that if you just look at the national debt. And that is part of the problem. That is this fiscal time bomb that is in the process of exploding. Because as the size of the national debt is skyrocketing, the interest that we have to pay on the national debt is skyrocketing too. The rates are going up. So the amount of debt that we have to finance is going up. And the interest that we have to pay to finance it is going up. And in fact, it's a compounding situation because we have to borrow the money to pay that interest. Remember, every nickel that the government pays in interest on the debt, it has to borrow. And all that additional borrowing adds to the national debt, which then has to be financed at a higher rate, right? This whole thing is in the process of imploding. That's the point that I'm making and the point that everybody is ignoring, including the Federal Reserve. And I want to talk about yesterday's speech that Jerome Powell gave in front of the Economic Club of New York, right? So, and I think I've spoken at the Economic Club of New York at some point in the past, you know. And, you know, if they really want to know what's going on in the economy or what's likely to happen in the future, that they ought to bring me back. I mean, forget about Powell. I mean, he's comic relief. I mean, he doesn't know what's going on. I mean, if he does, he's not going to be honest. He's going to lie. But, you know, he probably doesn't know. He's just clueless. And he lies on top of that. But if they want honest answers and actual legitimate, accurate answers, you know, I'm happy to come back and set the record straight. In fact, they should ask me every single question that they asked Jerome Powell, because my answer would pretty much be the opposite of his answer. But of course, my answers would be accurate and would actually, you know, have value. In fact, I'm sure that most of the members of the Economic Club of New York, maybe all the members, know more about economics than Jerome Powell, right? Because you have to flunk a test about economics in order to qualify to be chairman of the Federal Reserve. In fact, you probably can't even get to be a Federal Open Market Committee member if you actually know anything about economics, right? So they have to make sure that you flunk all these exams before they even allow you to be a member of the Fed. You know, people think these guys, you know, are the smartest of all of us, right? That's why they're there, because, you know, they're so super smart. And it's a good thing we have these, you know, geniuses, you know, at the Fed, you know, because all of us simpletons, you know, we can never survive. You know, we need their omnipotence, right? So they can divine exactly what the interest rate needs to be, right? Or what the inflation rate needs to be, and just, you know, magically, you know, get everything to come out perfectly, which, you know, hopefully at the end of this, all these people at the Fed will be completely discredited. But I want to go over some of the more ridiculous things that he said. And I'm just going to go back to my own Twitter account, because I was watching this stuff and I was tweeting out a bunch of stuff. And then I rewatched it again, you know, because I was distracted when I was watching it live. And I rewatched it later on that day. And then I tweeted out a bunch of, you know, more comments. I'm just going to go through them because this is going to remind me of what I want to talk about. But, you know, by the way, speaking about my Twitter account, if you're not following me on Twitter, follow me. At the end of this podcast, just, or, you know, just follow me on Twitter. I'm now less than 25,000 followers from a million. And that's a big milestone. I mean, reaching a million Twitter followers isn't easy. It's taken me a while. But the interesting thing about my Twitter followers is they're all organic. They're all real. There's no bots really that are following me. Maybe there's a few of them. But I've never advertised, I've never purchased a Twitter follower. You know, I go to like the Wall Street Journal Twitter page, and they got 25 million followers, 25 million. So 25 times the number of people who are following me. Yet if you look at their tweets, and they tweet even more than I do. I mean, there's like, they're nonstop tweeting over there at the Wall Street Journal, but nobody's reading these tweets. If you look at their engagement, you look at their, you know, their likes, their comments, their shares, they're all like double digits. Some of them are single digits. Then you look at my tweets. I mean, none of them are below triple digits. A lot of times they're quadruple digits in likes or shares or comments. So they have 25 times the number of followers I have. But I have like 100 times the engagement they have. So if you adjust it for followers, I mean, nobody is paying any attention. Why are these people even following? I mean, I have a feeling that a lot of these followers were just purchased, you know, so that the Wall Street Journal could look good. But also, I do think that people like to follow the Wall Street Journal to show how smart they are to everybody else who goes to their Twitter page, right? But I don't follow them, right? I don't have to pretend I'm smart and follow the Wall Street Journal. Because if I just read the Wall Street Journal, I probably wouldn't know nearly as much as I do, because I would be just as blind as everybody else. But anyway, let me get back. So just go ahead and help me get to a million organic, natural Twitter followers. And if you're following me, you don't need to follow the Wall Street Journal. So if you are following them, just unfollow them, right? It's a waste of a follow. Anyway, so here's the... My first observation. So one of the things that Powell said is he said we need to weaken economic growth because he wants to lower inflation. And so he's looking at the economy and he said, oh, you know, it's just too strong. We didn't realize it was going to be so strong. We need it to weaken a little bit because that's what's going to bring inflation down. Again, complete fallacy. It's a Keynesian myth that economic growth causes inflation. And I am going to continue to expose that myth and talk more about what Powell said to the Economic Club of New York on the other side of this commercial break. So stick around.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I'm talking about Jerome Powell's ridiculous comments that he made to questions asked of him at his talk at the Economic Club of New York. And first off, I'm talking about Powell's misconception that economic growth is what causes inflation. And if he wants to lower the inflation rate, he just has to slow down the growth of the economy. And that's BS. Now, when Powell is talking about economic growth, he's talking about consumer spending. He's looking at the spending numbers, retail sales numbers, GDP numbers, too, that are influenced by consumption, both by the government, too, and the individual, because government's spending a lot of money, too. And a lot of the money that people are spending, they're getting from the government, right, in the form of checks. But that's not economic growth. That's just spending. That's not growing the economy. That's spending what a growing economy produces, except a lot of the growth is happening in Asia, in other countries, because we're spending on imports. And we're also borrowing money. Debt is at record highs. I mean, the reason that consumers are spending more is because they're paying more, number one, right? Prices have gone way up, so everything costs more. And they're borrowing more to pay those higher prices. Now, some of the consumers, as I mentioned, have had to take on second and third jobs to pay those higher prices. So if you're just looking at the spending and you think, oh, we have this really strong economy. No, it's not a strong economy. You're looking at inflation. That's what's going on. Inflation is driving this spending. It's not a strong economy. And you don't need to weaken the economy to reduce inflation. You just have to reduce the spending. And how do you do that? Well, you know, much higher interest rates, much higher than we have, but the government has to cut back on spending. They got to, you know, cut back on welfare spending, or they even raise taxes and start paying down debt. But it's much better if they just cut government spending. But also, interest rates need to rise high enough so that people spend less of their paychecks. Again, we don't want people to stop working. No, if they stop working, they're not producing. That means there's less stuff. That puts upward pressure on prices. We want everybody to keep working. We just want them to stop spending everything they earn. They need to take some of their paychecks and save it, put it in the bank. But they're not going to do that because the bank's not paying any interest. And even if you get interest on a government bond by loaning your money to the government, which doesn't help the economy, when you put it in the bank, at least it could be loaned out to a businessman. But when you buy treasuries, you just, you know, the money's going to the government. They're just blowing it on consumption. But people aren't going to save when the interest rates are still not high enough to compensate you for inflation. So we don't want to weaken the economy. We want to weaken spending. But Powell doesn't know the difference. He thinks spending is the economy. He thinks that it's the consumer that drives the economy by spending money. I went over this last podcast. No, the consumer is the caboose. He's driven by the real engine of the economy, which is production. That's what we need more of. We need a stronger economy, but we need less spending, less consumption, more savings, more investment. None of that is happening. Powell doesn't understand that, so nothing that he's doing is going to be effective at bringing inflation down to 2%. Now, another thing that Powell did is he blamed today's inflation on the pandemic. He kept saying, well, it's the pandemic inflation, like everything was fine, and then this pandemic happened. And now we have to deal with the pandemic inflation, and it's just taking longer to just get rid of this, you know, pandemic inflation. Again, the pandemic is not why we have inflation. The Fed is why we have inflation. Congress, the president, are why we have inflation. And not just Biden, but Trump and the presidents before him. They were all contributing to the inflation problem that we're dealing with today. Now, did we create even more inflation during COVID? Yes, we made the inflation problem worse, but it wasn't COVID. It wasn't the pandemic that did it. It was the government's response to the pandemic. That's what was the problem, not the pandemic. The pandemic was a health problem. But what the government did is turned it into an inflation problem because they overreacted, number one. They forced people to stop working, and then they ran huge deficits to send people stimulus checks to buy stuff that they weren't making. The worst possible combination of monetary and fiscal policy ever devised. And I call them out on it in real time as they were making the mistakes, and I described exactly what was going to happen. In fact, I remember on my podcast when I called the peak of the bond bubble that started in 1980 when yields collapsed and, you know, the yields had a zero handle, like it was 0.6, 0.7 on a 10-year or a 30-year. I said, that's it. This is done. The bond bull market is over. This is a blow-off top. And, you know, we're going much, much higher. And now we're at 5%. We're at the highest yield since 2007. And we're not even close to the end. We're going much, much higher than that. And, you know, that's part of this, you know, evolving financial crisis. But again, Powell doesn't understand where the inflation came from, if he's being honest. And so if he doesn't know why we have inflation, how is he gonna get rid of it? Well, he's not. And if he's just lying about it, well, you can't trust anything that he says. Now, he got a question about the banks. The guy asked him, and I forget who was asking these questions, but he asked him, you know, about the Silicon Valley Bank failure. And he said, you know, are we out of the woods, right? Is the banking problem over? And he basically said, yeah, you know, it's pretty much behind us. You know, we got that handled. It's just starting. That was the tip of the iceberg. And what doesn't make sense is if you look at how much value has been lost in mortgage-backed securities and treasuries since the March bailout of Silicon Valley Bank. It's been an enormous collapse. And so the banks today are in far worse shape than they were back in March when Silicon Valley Bank failed or was bailed out or everybody else was bailed out. And the Fed should know this because the Fed is the biggest loser of them all because the Fed has more treasuries and mortgage-backed securities on its balance sheet than anybody else. So the Fed is the biggest loser, and somehow they think the crisis is behind us when it's all out in front of us and it's about to be playing out in front of their eyes. Now, I can't imagine that he's this dumb. I mean, he's got to be just lying on that one. I mean, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that he's not a complete idiot and he's just lying because, you know, like Jack Nicholson, I mean, nobody can handle the truth because he knows this thing is being televised, right? He knows people are watching CNBC, Bloomberg, Fox Business. Everybody's, you know, got him up on television. You know, and he's not going to scare the bejesus out of the markets by telling the truth. So he's got a lie. Let me get my next comment. I thought this was interesting too. Is that they did talk about maybe there's not as much demand for treasuries out there. Yeah, that's a massive understatement. The Chinese, the Japanese. Everybody, I think, has been unloading U.S. treasuries. I mean, they're major sellers, as is the Federal Reserve, which continues to shrink its balance sheet. It's only a question of time, though, until the dollar tanks. I mean, it hasn't really rallied recently, but, you know, it's got to get killed because the main demand for dollars really is to buy treasuries. I mean, that's why people want dollars. It's not like they want to buy our products because they don't need them to buy our products. We got a huge trade deficit, right? So they got plenty of dollars to buy our products from selling us stuff that we didn't make. And they got lots of dollars left over. So what do they do with those dollars that they have left over? Well, they buy treasuries. Well, if they're not going to buy treasuries, what are they going to do with them? Well, nothing. Why keep them? Get rid of them. If you're not going to buy treasuries, which, you know, treasuries now really are one of the riskiest assets on the planet. I mean, look at how much they've gone down. I mean, look at that, you know, that TLT security is down like 57% or something from its peak. People thought that was like a risk-free asset. I was warned for years about how risky these treasury bonds were, and that thing has still got a long way to fall. I mean, it's pure risk. People were saying, oh, it's risk off. Let's buy treasuries. No. You got plenty of risk when you own treasuries. If you want to take risk off, you got to sell treasuries. Well, then what do you buy when you sell treasuries? Aha, gold. And I'm going to talk about what happened with gold when I finish dissecting the Powell comments. So I got to keep scrolling up on this. And in fact, the backup in yields, the fact that the 30-year treasury is now above 5% and rising, what does that tell you? that tells you that the markets are losing confidence in the Fed's ability to keep inflation at 2%. That's why the yields are rising. Of course, Powell doesn't get that, and I'm going to get to that question in a minute. I'm just trying to... So here's the next point I tweeted about. I couldn't believe this. So Powell started talking about the risks of inflation being too low again, right? He said that inflation can be too high or too low and that both are risks. And he said that for a while, we had the problem of inflation being too low. And he said now, you know, it's too high. But he's worried that at some point in the future, it's going to be too low again. And now he's going to have to deal with that problem. Like, that's a great problem to have because, A, it's not even a problem. But the consumer can use some relief. But low inflation was never a problem. That was a made-up problem so they can have an excuse to create more inflation. Now we've got a real problem of inflation being too high. Remember, it was in 2020 when Powell first introduced the concept of inflation averaging, where he said, you know, we don't have 2% as a target. We want inflation to average 2% over time. Because they wanted to justify letting inflation get to 2.25, 2.5. They didn't want to have to put on the brakes when we hit 2. They wanted to make up for all the years where we were below 2. So they redefined their target to an average inflation rate of 2%. Yeah, no one talks about that now. I mean, they haven't officially changed that. I mean, how many years are we going to have 1% inflation to average it down to 2? Because even the Fed doesn't claim it's going to get inflation down to 2% until 2025. So that's like 4 or 5 years of inflation, double, triple, quadruple, 2. I mean, 1%, we need 0. We need falling prices to average back down to 2%. Of course, no. They never want to do that. They only want to average up the low inflation. They never want to average down the high inflation. So it's all a bunch of BS. But here's one of the craziest things that he said. He was asked about the fiscal deficits, which are exploding, which are a huge problem, especially since he's raising interest rates and making those deficits harder to finance and bigger at the same time. So he was asked about it. And this is what Powell said. He said that he doesn't consider fiscal policy at all when he's making monetary policy. Like, no one at the FOMC gives a damn. They don't even look at the federal budget. It's like some irrelevant thing that they don't even pay attention to, right? We don't care what's happening. And he also said that they don't adjust their policy based on what's happening with fiscal policy. Like, it's got nothing to do with their mandate when it has everything to do with their mandate. Where's the inflation coming from? It's coming from the budget deficits that he monetizes. And government spending is driving inflation. If you're trying to slow down the economy or just trying to cool consumption, if the government is increasing spending, that is counteracting what you're trying to do. How could you avoid that? How could you not care about that? In fact, the very reason the Fed is supposed to be independent is so it could push back against reckless fiscal policy. The Fed is supposed to be the chaperone here at this spending party. And if Congress is spending too much money, well, jack up rates, make it harder for them to do that. Raise the cost of borrowing so that they cut back. It makes no sense. Like a doctor saying, yeah, I don't pay any attention to the patient's symptoms. I just prescribe whatever the hell I feel like. And then I don't even watch the patient to see how it reacts to my prescription. Like, it's irrelevant, you know. I mean, the patient could die, and well, I don't care about that. I'm just doing what I'm doing. I'm not looking. Or you're, you know, it none of this makes any sense. It's one of the most important things. If your responsibility is price stability, one of the most important things that you've got to consider is the fiscal situation of the U.S. government. I mean, that's the debt. And if you're worried about a crisis, shouldn't you be worried about a debt crisis? Shouldn't you be worried? I mean, remember, I talked about it. Paul Volcker, when he actually won a fight against inflation, unlike Powell, who's losing, he criticized Congress all the time. He said, you got to cut spending. You got to reduce the deficit, so we're never going to get rid of inflation. He was honest. Powell's a liar, or he doesn't know what he's talking about. Of course, fiscal deficits matter. In fact, right now, they matter more than ever before, and Powell is clueless about what's going on. All right, he really is like a Mr. Magoo. You know, I used to call Greenspan Mr. Magoo for all the stuff he was missing, because he at least looked a little bit more like him. But Powell is just, you know, walking around, and there's accidents happening all around him, and he had got no idea what's going on. And to make it even worse, when he was asked about the backup in long-term interest rates, which, of course, is the biggest problem out there, right, what's happening with long-term interest rates. And the guy asked him, you know, why are they going up? And, of course, you know, Powell probably has no idea. You know, he doesn't understand. But the first thing he said is, well, I'll tell you why they're not going up. He said they're not going up because of inflation. He says yields are not going up because bond investors are worried about higher inflation. Really? How does he know that? Seems like a very self-serving answer, because his job is to fight inflation. He claims that he's doing a good job. So the first thing he says is, okay, well, I'll tell you one thing. The reason that those yields are not going up is because of inflation. It's got nothing to do with that. Well, you know, that's exactly why they're going up. That's the fact. Maybe that's the reason he had to say that that's not why they're going up, because he wants to throw people off the track. Because, of course, that's why they're going up. People need to be compensated for higher inflation. Now, the funny thing about it is he admitted that part of the problem could be supply, right? He said, well, maybe that bond investors are worried about rising deficits, or that there's going to be more treasuries on the market, and so maybe that could be causing higher yields. Yeah, but because that means more inflation. The bigger the budget deficits are, the more likely there is to be inflation. You see, Powell may not be paying attention to the budget deficits, but bond investors are finally paying attention to the budget deficits. They know that those budget deficits lead to more inflation. Powell apparently hasn't figured that out yet, or he's just lying about it. But I mean, that was probably going to be, you know, go down if you know, in history for his legacy of failure, you know, how he fiddled while, you know, Rome burned, where he said, oh, yeah, we don't care. We don't care about the fiscal deficits. We don't worry about the national debt. We don't worry about the budget deficits. You know, there was a guy on CNBC today, Michael Boskin, who is the president of the Atlanta Fed. He's not voting right now, but he was on CNBC this morning. And I forget who was interviewing. Maybe it was Steve Leisman or whoever it was, said something like, well, what about the fiscal situation in the United States? Do you think this is sustainable? I mean, we got these big deficits. We got the national debt. And so Boskin said, well, you know, eventually they won't be sustainable. He said at some point in the future, as interest rates keep rising, these deficits won't be sustainable. And then Congress is going to have to start talking about it. You know, like, the time to talk about it has long since passed. In fact, they needed to do something about it, and they didn't. That was the problem. They only talked about it, and they did nothing, and then they stopped talking. But to say that it's not sustainable until the future, when interest rates goes up, it's not sustainable right now, because interest rates have already gone up. In fact, it was unsustainable before they went up, because we knew they were going to go up. To say it's not unsustainable until after they go up, again, I said this on the last podcast, if you jump off the top of the Empire State Building, you know, you're done. You can't say it's not a problem until I hit the pavement. The minute you jumped, hitting the pavement is inevitable. So this problem has been there. It has been unsustainable for years. It's just that we were able to pretend that it wasn't because we can afford the interest, just like you can pretend you're okay, you know, assuming you stay alive for that fall from the top of the building until you actually hit the pavement. Well, we're about to hit that pavement, right? So, you know, we're gonna suffer the consequences of this unsustainable deficit. In fact, we're seeing them right now. They're playing out before the blind eyes of our policymakers. Now, let me see if I had some more comments from Powell. I forget what else. I think that's it. I think those are all of my Powell tweets. There may have been some other ridiculous comments that he made that I didn't tweet about because, you know, it's only so much time I have. Pretty much everything he said was wrong or laughable or a lie. But anyway, I want to get to the market action during the week, because the last 4 days of the week were particularly interesting. Forget about Monday. But from Tuesday through Friday, the stock market was down every day. Now, the Dow, I think, on Monday was about flat, but the S&P and the NASDAQ were down. But on Wednesday, the Dow dropped too. But pretty much the overall stock market dropped 4 days in a row as interest rates rose all of those days until today. Right? And they hit new highs today, but we had a little bit of a rally. But the stock market was closed on the lows or close to the lows. Very ugly technical action. Those 4 days, the NASDAQ was down 4% during those 4 days. So average 1% per day. I mean, that's pretty big. I mean, if that continues, that adds up to a lot. The interesting thing about that is that while tech stocks are now reacting the way they should to rising bond yields, gold stopped acting the way it shouldn't and is now acting the way it should by going up. Gold was up every day for those 4 days. In fact, it was up about almost $60 over those 4 days. It closed the week at 1981. Now, if you remember, 2 weeks ago today, I did a podcast. It was the Friday that we got the jobs report. Gold is $160 higher than the low from that Friday. And we almost hit 2,000 an ounce earlier this morning before we got some profit taking in gold. So I guess that round number, I think the futures got above 2,000, but the spot market, I think the high I saw was about 1997 before we backed off, you know, to 1981. But just based on where we closed, it's $160. But to the high, it was almost a $180 rally in 2 weeks. That tells me something. And, you know, I think I was pretty accurate in my call on that Friday that we had bottomed in gold, because I really liked the one-day outside reversal day, which to me looked pretty strong. Plus, I was looking for a bottom anyway, because I knew that everything that was going on was very bullish for gold. And, you know, the stuff that's happening in the Middle East, which unfortunately, as I said, is just getting progressively worse, and I expect that trend to continue, unfortunately, this is just adding another bullish element to the gold story, which didn't need any more help, by the way. It was already going to go way up. And oil, too, you know, oil continued to rise. It didn't get above 90. It was at 89.60, 89.70. And then it had a little bit of a sell-off today. It closed at 88 a barrel. But oil prices continued to rise. I expect, again, a much bigger rise. The charts look great for oil and gold. And, again, bond yields, too. They're all moving in the same direction. But this is significant that we saw this move up, because gold is now breaking free of this relationship it's had with bonds. Gold and bonds were falling together. Now gold is rising as bonds are falling. That is a important missing piece to this puzzle, which is in the process of being completed, because gold is now taking over as the safe haven. Treasuries are a risk asset. They're not a safe haven. Again, what is the risk? Inflation. The risk is also the fiscal predicament of the United States, which causes more inflation. But if that is your risk, if you're worried about spiraling budget deficits and inflation, the last thing you'd want to do is buy treasuries. And so they're not a safe haven. What is a safe haven from inflation and a sovereign debt crisis? Gold. That's what investors are doing. They're buying gold. But even gold stock investors haven't figured this out yet, because while gold was up 3% in 4 days, Gold stocks didn't move very much. The GDX was up like 1.7%. The GDXJ was up 2% during those 4 days. Normally, if gold was up 3%, actually it was up 3.2%, you would expect those stocks to be up double, maybe 7%, you know, on a move like that, 6.5%. Didn't happen. Why? Because gold is climbing a wall of worry. The investors who buy gold stocks don't believe the rally. They've seen this before. They've seen gold get up to 2,000, and it doesn't hold. Now, maybe some people think, well, it's all just about the Middle East. It's about Israel. It'll blow over. Well, first of all, the problem in Israel ain't blowing over. It's going to be here for a long time. So even if that was the reason gold was rising, you know, it's going to be a long time before that situation is resolved. But that's not the reason. It's rising because of inflation. It's rising because of a loss of confidence in the Fed, in its ability to return inflation to 2%, a loss of confidence in the sustainability of the U.S. Fiscal situation that is spiraling out of control. So I do think that we're going to break through that 2,000 resistance, but then I think gold is going to break through to new highs, because if rising interest rates aren't going to hurt gold, then that's it. There's nothing left. And it was the rising interest rates that were also pushing up the dollar. The dollar hasn't started to fall, but it ain't going up anymore. It didn't really gain any ground this week on the rise in bond yields. In fact, let me look at the dollar index on the week, and it actually declined on the week. So that's another good sign. Gold was up, shrugged off rising rates. The dollar declined, shrugged off rising rates. So this, again, brings us closer to this crashing dollar, crashing bonds, rising gold, that brings us much, much closer to this financial crisis kicking in to a higher gear. As I said, we just started. It's early in the crisis, but it is going to continue to get worse. Now, I got a comment, too, to close off the podcast on Bitcoin, because people are going to say, Peter, why are you talking about gold? Look at Bitcoin. Bitcoin was way up. Bitcoin actually got above 30,000 today, this morning. That's the highest it's been in a long time. Let me see where it is right now as I am recording this podcast. I know it didn't hold 30,000. 29,600 and change. But, you know, it's close enough, right? It had a strong day, stronger than gold, stronger week than gold. But it didn't rise for the same reason. It didn't rise because of safe haven. It rose because speculators are betting on an ETF. In particular, the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust now filed to convert to an ETF. This is something that Schoenstein, or I forget whoever the guys, I debated that guy, Barry. There's two guys, I forget their names, but that run a Grayscale. But they've been trying to get this ETF for years. Of course, it's the worst thing that can happen to their business model, because they charge a 2% management fee. And so that's huge, just to babysit your Bitcoin. But their AUM is going to collapse once this thing goes to an ETF. And of course, when it is an ETF, they're not even going to be able to charge 2% management fees anymore, because no one's going to keep their money there. They're going to take it out and go to another ETF that charges less. The reason they couldn't do that before was a closed-end fund. But a lot of people bought the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. The discount got to almost 50%. So you could buy a dollar's worth of Bitcoin for 50 cents. Now, of course, a dollar's worth of Bitcoin is worth nothing. So you bought nothing for 50 cents. But at least market-wise, what was trading in the market at a dollar, you could buy for 50 cents. I think that the discount now has narrowed all the way back to about 12. But remember, for years, it was trading at a 20, 30% premium, right, before it crashed. But a lot of people were buying the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust, waiting for it to become an ETF so that the discount would go away. And now they're going to sell. So what's going to happen when this thing is finally an ETF? All the people who were buying it, hoping it would become an ETF, are going to sell. The trade is done. They made their money. They won. Now it's time to ring the cash register and sell. And so what does that mean? That means that all these Bitcoin, and there's like, based on today's price, I don't know, $13, $14 billion worth of Bitcoin that have been locked up in this trust for years, right? It was a roach motel for Bitcoin. They check in, but they can't check out. Well, now all the roaches can get out because now people can get their money back. Before, you could sell your shares, but you had to sell to another buyer. And that's why there was a discount. But now you could just get your money back. But how does Grayscale give you your money back? They got to take the Bitcoin that they've got, sell them to get the cash to give people their money. So I think that there's going to be a wave of Bitcoin selling when this thing becomes an ETF. Everybody thinks that, no, there's all these people are just waiting to buy the ETF. Like for some reason, they don't want to buy now. They want to wait till there's an ETF and then buy. No, I think people are waiting for an ETF to sell. You know, it's buy the rumor, sell the fact. It's not buy the rumor and buy more on the fact. In fact, they may start selling on the rumor of the fact. I mean, this thing could collapse any day because I think a lot of the people who are waiting to ring that cash register are not going to get as much money out of this trade as they think, because I think we're going to start the collapse in Bitcoin and Grayscale, because once Bitcoin starts going down, it's going to drag down the Grayscale trust before it actually happens. I think so. The smart money is not waiting to sell on the news. They're selling now on the rumor of the news. Anyway, that's it for today's podcast. Again, let me remind everybody, if you stuck around for 57 minutes, you must like the content. So don't forget to hit that like button, subscribe to this channel, leave me a comment. You know, I want to let everybody know, too, because I teased about this some time ago, but we're having a big party here at my house tomorrow night. I can still hear the music outside the studio. We're doing some rehearsals. We got about 400 people coming over to my house for a Halloween party. But one thing that's special about the party, well, there are actually a number of things, but particularly to me, is my wife is making her debut with her new band. I talked about this at one point in the podcast, and soon I think we're going to have her music out there where you guys can, you know, get it on iTunes or wherever people post their music. But she partnered up with a guy named Tony Fratinelli, who was the original guitarist for Third Eye Blind, who happened to be a big Peter Schiff fan, and that's how he reached out to me. But then he kind of hooked up, you know, with my wife on collaborating on some music. And so they have about a dozen songs now that they've written, original music. So Tony composes the music, and my wife wrote the lyrics and is the vocal. And it's a two-man or a man and a woman group. They call themselves the Laughing Cats. So they're going to make their debut. They're going to be performing a number of their original songs live at this party. So once it's out, I'll be sharing the music with everybody, and you can hopefully enjoy it. I think it's good stuff. It's very popular music. It's catchy, so I think it could do well. If you want to see some images of this party, I'm sure she's going to put everything up on her Instagram page. So if you have to figure out who my wife is, but she's up there. She's on Instagram. So hopefully she does a great job. I'm very proud of her and the work that she's put in to this performance and all of these songs that she's worked so hard to create. And now she's going to perform them for a live audience for the first time. Anyway, have a great weekend, everybody. And I will be back again with more podcasts as this financial crisis continues to unfold in a way that nobody but us seems to be able to see it. But eventually, what we can see will be obvious to the rest of the world. But by then, of course, it will be too late for them to do anything about it. But for my audience, it's not too late. You still have time. So buy your gold, get your financial house in order before the whole house comes tumbling down. Bye for now.